next session, number 28750, Reel 5.
Laurie Manton, Reel 5. I think you're going to tell me about the post-battle experience now.
One of the things I needed to do once the war was over and we got settled in our tent in the desert of Kuwait, and that was the need to go and interview people about their experiences in the war. Now, I started off by doing two major interviews, one with Patrick Cordonley, who commanded 7th Armour Brigade, and the other being with Christopher Hammerbeck, the other brigade commander, who commanded 4 Brigade. In the case of Patrick Cordonley, he spent an hour and a half running through the 100-hour war from beginning to end with his full personal experiences, which was an electrifying experience for me. It was absolutely wonderful, and the clarity with which he told this his story, which was a complete contrast to Christopher Hammerbeck, who I think, this is only a personal opinion, and he's left the army now. I think he went to banking in Hong Kong or somewhere. He was bitter that he hadn't received the publicity that Patrick Cordonley and 7th Armour Brigade had. But then they'd been out there months beforehand, before they were reinforced by Christopher Hammerbeck's thing. So his account, which I also have on tape, is a bitter account, almost sarcastic in his telling. For example, you know, people think we just did this, but in reality we did this, that, and we achieved, and all the rest of it. So very bitter, and I didn't like that interview at all, whereas Patrick Cordonley's was lively, interesting, and you know, all you'd expect of someone like him. But I then went on to find people who had actually engaged into the fighting, and I found a tank crew, interviewed them to see what it was like fighting, whereas they were spent their time looking through their periscopes and seeing their shells go off and hit the enemy or have fire coming towards them. And they described things like, you know, when they came near Iraqi positions, there was someone tapping on the hull of their tank, and someone said, "Who's that tapping?" And they realised it was machine gun fire, bullets hitting the armour. But they were discussing that, you know, they were just seeing sort of lights and an explosion. To them, it was like a video game. It wasn't until after the war that they actually had an organised battlefield tour to see what they'd knocked out. And when they stuck their heads in the tanks to see what they'd done to the Iraqis, they realised that that could have been them. Now, it's quite interesting with the tanks of today, because certain of the rounds, and I think it's a SABO round, S-A-B-O-T, that hits the side of the tank, hits the armour, and inside it breaks off a dinner plate sized chunk of metal, which then whizzes around at huge speeds, slicing up the whole interior of the tank and everyone in it. So you'd think they'd be killed by the fact that the round hit the armour and gone through it and then exploded, but it doesn't actually do that. It minces everything and everyone inside, which is not a particularly nice way to go. So they were quite shocked, having had a successful battle, to then go on and see the results of their handiwork, and then equate it to the fact that it could have been them themselves. Whereas the infantry soldiers, they were quite fascinating, because they even got to the point of bayoneting Iraqis when they were fighting in the Iraqi slit trenches. And a young man who I photographed became known as really the luckiest British soldier alive, because he'd got his SA-80 rifle, charged in an Iraqi trench, and just as he got there, this Iraqi stood up and fired a round, which then hit this young soldier who was in the Staffordshire Regiment, hit him in the chest, knocked him over, and he's flying through the air, and he said before he hit the ground, he was shouting, "Medic." And he laid there, and he thought, "Oh, I'm all right." And reached, no blood. And he carried his magazine of bullets in his breast pocket of his combat jacket. And the bullet had hit that and lodged in it. And that's stopped him being killed. So I got a nice photograph of him holding the metal magazine up with a hole in it, and the hole in his pocket of his uniform that he was...
Why didn't they go off, the bullets?
Don't know. Luck? Miracle? If it was me, it would probably all go bang and fly off everywhere. But some of the interviews were quite... I found a little disturbing, and there was a Private Malt, who was in the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers, and he'd been killed. And he jumped down outside his vehicle. They'd all disembarked, and Iraqi fired a rocket-propelled grenade at him, which hit him squarely in the chest. And he evidently looked just like a polo. It was just a big hole in the middle of him. He died, and then the regiment itself, the Fusiliers, were very upset because they'd lost another soldier who'd just been fixing a track after the war, and had set off a mine which killed him, sort of dropped his big crowbar which hit the mine which killed the guy. But it was interesting to see the soldiers, and I interviewed from officer right down to the lowest rank that had actually fought the Iraqis, they all seemed, they weren't gung-ho in their attitude, but they were very matter-of-fact about all the killing that they'd done. And I always thought it'd be interesting to see what they're like now, whether any of the young Scots soldiers, for example, are on the streets of Glasgow as Alkies because they, you know, been unable to settle down. And I think it's something that's coming out of the second Gulf War, that people go and have post-traumatic stress disorders. You know, it's quite difficult for them.
Did you interview anyone who had been involved in the area, or, you know, witnessed anything of this? One hears of the Iraqi soldiers who were sort of bulldozed in their trenches. Is there any truth in that? That they were actually sort of overrun by tanks?
I didn't witness it, but I'm absolutely certain it took place. They were in the trenches amongst the berms, and the bulldozers just went in and bulldozed the berms and de facto buried them. That's it. Eventually they would have died through suffocation. Not particularly nice, but one of those things. You can't go up to the big sandbank and pop your head up and say, "Do you chaps just move off or you'll get buried alive?" You just go and clear the people. But no, I think that was absolutely a real thing.
And also, did any of the people speak of their feelings about the incidents of friendly fire?
Yes, I would say I was in the media area when we were all called in by the military PR people, who revealed to us that, you know, that so many people have been killed and injured from this. And there was occasionally a journalist would become too associated with wearing a military uniform and become sort of cocky, arrogant, sort of bastard type personality. And one of them was turned completely military, and I remember he arrived late and he burst in and he said, "Right, what's going on here then?" You know, as if he was an officer. "Is this right? You know, so many people have been killed. Can we report it?" And the officer said, "No, not yet." Because he said, "Why not?" And he got, you know, threatened. You know, "Calm down, shut up. We need to tell the next kin first." And it was a big sanitary lesson for this guy who became bigger than his own ego, for his own sense. But I think, you know, K-80 was there and such like, and they were all shocked to hear this. And I'm aware that people were very upset about the killing. But I think it was acknowledged at the time there was always some criticism of the RAF air controller who had an involvement in this, who was liaising with the American people. I don't think it's ever been said whether, you know, who was to blame or what have you, but you know, I think that's a case where I wouldn't go further on, you know, for obvious reasons. There's a lot I know that I'm not telling you, but as this may well reach the public.
By the way, you do, perhaps I should have been more specific, you know, with the access. You do have control over this. If there's anything you would like to put on the record that you wouldn't like released without your permission, fine. Mm. So I leave that to you.
Yes, no, I'm fine with that. But, you know, there are some things that I would still consider as military secrets.
Yes.
Even at this
We will leave that to your, you know, obviously, judgment.
I'm self-censoring because it saves a lot of time. Well, but as you asked me specifically about the friendly fire one, then, you know, I went as far as I could go on that one.
Did you ever come across John Keane, the other war artist?
Yes, I did. Now, he was quite interesting. I was really chuffed the other week to go on the internet and track down a photograph of him sat in front of myself and Mike, the photographer, in our tent before the ground war started, because he came out to visit us and... he was quite an interesting artist. He'd done a lot of sort of anti-authority painting, Nicaraguan paintings and things like this, which is vastly different from when I was in Bosnia, when I met Peter Howson, who did those amazing Bosnian paintings, who first suffered from shell shock and had abandoned his very first mission out there and then came back and did it. But John Keane worked on found material, i.e. he found a nuclear, biological and chemical warfare instruction book on how to protect yourself, and he'd incorporate that into a painting. And he also photographed a lot using a pre-war Leica that belonged to his father, and I'm not sure whether his father actually looted it from the Germans during the war. But he ummed and ahed about whether to accompany the British troops on the land war. And I think from our discussions, as he spent about a week living in our tent, he decided he was too frightened, to put it in simple terms, to go on the ground war. So he ended up on a ship and then was flown by helicopter off the ship into Kuwait after the war was over. And I think regretted not doing the ground war. That said, a lot of people couldn't understand his his paintings. And I'm trying to think where his paintings were on display. They're on display at the Imperial War Museum in London. And I came up because I recognised what had gone on and the subjects of some of the paintings. And it's very interesting because I went in the room and there were a couple of people saying to the attendant, I don't understand these paintings at all. So I said, well, do you want these paintings put in context? And I was able to take them around saying, right, you know, here we've got a photograph of Captain Bruce of the Argyle and Sullivan Highlanders, who's escorted Kate Aidy to this. And they were saying, what about the Mickey Mouse and the rocket-propelled grenades in a shopping trolley in Kuwait City? And I said, that's as it was. And having seen his photographs of it, there were all these abandoned Disney rides standing around, and there was Mickey Mouse. There was piles of poo about where the Iraqi soldiers had just pooed on the ground instead of digging holes or using toilets. And there literally was a shopping trolley with rocket-propelled grenades sort of piled up in the top of it. So it was all authentic, and they were all in the same area. But what he'd actually done was push the trolley over to the Mickey Mouse, which is not dissimilar to my moving the doll onto the pile of rubble. So that was at first disappointed by his paintings. When I had a good look at them up at the Imperial War Museum, then I was able to understand them a lot better. And indeed, I bought several books about him since and looked at the images that he did of the troops and in Kuwait City, and still enjoy looking at those pictures.
There was one guest, wasn't there? I remember, which reminded me of when you were talking about putting your suit on.
Yes, that had the person with their noddy suit and respirator on in the back of the vehicle, and he'd ripped out pages from this NBC instruction manual and used it as almost as a collage. And that was very authentic, you know, and I could almost recognise myself or any other person who wore a respirator assisting the vehicle with the staring eyes through the gas mask. But no, that was quite an interesting paper, and I think it was Fumbling with Gas? It sort of equates to one of the famous poems.
Yes, it's the cry, isn't it? Gas, 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 or something.
Yeah,
and he's got the line. I forget.
Because when you've got a certain length of time, just a few seconds, to get your respirator on if there is an attack, and as the respirator's coming up to your face, you have to scream gas, 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 which not only lets people around you know it's gas, 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 but that air is hitting the inside of the respirator and expelling any contaminated air and thus lessening the effect, so you're like blowing to clear it out before it goes on your face, which is why they shout gas, gas, gas.
It's interesting, you know, having met, and perhaps I can ask you about Peterhausen when you come into Serbia later, because you've said so much about the photography, which is so interesting, I think. And so, you know, and obviously this role for a war photographer. Do you think a war artist is, you know, is complimentary or is important
very
to have actually
so.
Someone like John Keane?
Well, since over the last 5 years or so, I've been studying art myself because I've always been a frustrated photographer. I've always wanted to be an artist. I can understand what they do now. And since the Gulf War, I'd accrued a massive collection of, almost a library of books on war correspondents and war photographers, and indeed collected material from people like Ernie Powell, the famous reporter in America of the Second World War, and various war photographers and war correspondents' memorabilia from around the world. So I've got this stuff, but I've got a huge collection of war artist stuff, so, you know, I can appreciate it. And certainly John Keane is up there with them. You know, I've researched all the war artists of the First and Second World War. He's contemporary, if you like, even though it was the very early 90s. But he stands up well with, you know, some of the best of them. Whereas Howson, when we discuss him, is more stylized, and you know, it's the sort of art that might appeal to a young person who works in the city, who earns far more money than sense. It still has impact, but it's grotesque, and you know, I don't really like the stuff that he's done.
You know, it's interesting what you've been saying about journalists so far. And you obviously work with Kate Adey in the field. How did you get on with Kate Adey?
Well, it's interesting. Kate Adey, I found really professional. And there was the standing joke with the British Army. You know, things don't get bad or serious until Kate Adey comes on the scene. And once Kate had arrived, they realised that they really were going to go to war. And then, you know, I go on and meet her in northern Iraq with the Kurds when she suddenly appears in a jeep whizzing through the countryside. And again, met her in Sarajevo. So I've, you know, seen her working in uniform and working in civilians outside the military system, if you like. But she was such a professional and a wonderful person, because before the ground war started, she decided she would create a Last Supper for the senior officers and certain of the journalists, which included myself. And she created this huge dinner party. Now, to do that in the desert with limited rations is pretty incredible. I'll give you an example. She had got hold of a Mars bar from the Neffy shop and sliced it so thinly with a razor blade to create the equivalent of after 8 minutes to go with the coffee and all these wonderful things. And it was almost like a black tie dinner in combat kit, and she organised that, and it was brilliant. You know, she was utterly fantastic, and I can't remember whether she was one of the lucky ones, which was a real curious, well, there were two curious incidents in the run up to the war which have just come back to mind, both valid in their same way. One was the fact that they decided in the new year to select some troops and take them off to the desert. There was an invite. So I was lucky enough to get invited to go along with this. And we were all thrown in a Hercules, landing in the middle of the desert somewhere in Saudi Arabia, chucked in army trucks and driven for Mars. And suddenly, and we are talking about remote area here, there is a huge tent in the desert. You know, the sort of tent you could fit Waterloo Station into. It was big. And we've been invited to dinner with King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. So we went in there, and it's laid out with carpets, and there were great big mats, and almost bonfire-sized piles of rice, and then meats and fruits and everything. And everyone sat cross-legged with the king for 2 or 3 hours, stuffing themselves full of this fantastic Arab food. All the squaddies, you know, they whip out their little happy snap cameras, take a photograph, and the guards were confiscating the cameras. And I wandered around and took photograph after photograph and wasn't stopped. And yet I was undistinguishable from them. So I've got all these fantastic photos of the king's meal for the British troops. And I don't think that ever got reported in the paper. It's a really curious little event, whether it was a sort of thank you or something like that.
Well, what stage in the war would this have been? Was it after the war or...?
Just before the war started. So it was certainly post-Christmas. And I think, was it January or February, the air war started?
How amazing. Was it very luxurious, this tent, the inside, the interior?
Oh, it was, yeah. It was just saying, it was like being in a Hollywood movie. Now, prior to that, they decided to have a review of the coalition forces by King Fahd. And they got everyone out in the desert. So I go out there with my camera. King Fahd's in his tent. And they get all these troops on parade. So there's a sound of marching drums and trumpets and such like. And they had the French Foreign Legion out there. Well, they came out in their combats, but with their Foreign Legion kepis, with the, you know, the white sort of scarf down the back of the neck, absolutely spectacular. And then the Syrians came out, and they all had badges of, trying to think who the president was, Assad?
Yeah.
And then the Saudi forces and all these different forces. And we were taking photographs of King Fahd. And these guys in green berets, who were bodyguards, rounded us all up and arrested us. And I saw one of the princes come round, and he had what looked like a European male photographer taking photographs. And I said, "Hey," he says, "what are you lot doing in there?" He was an American photographer who was engaged full-time to document the Saudi royal family. I said, "We've been arrested." So he spoke to the security guys in red berets, who then went and got their batons out and beat the security officials in green berets over the head, and we were let go and could do what I want. So we got let go. And me, because I'm always after the extraordinary, I went round the back of this parade. You can imagine thousands of troops lined up, the front line, absolutely smart, like the guards on parade at Buckingham Palace or Troop in the Colour. Behind was a different matter, because they were many deep. And it was a bit like It Ain't My Fault, Mum, because it was full of traders selling tea and little nibbles round the back there. And the funny thing is, with Arab troops, if you're going to take a leak, if you're a male European, you would wander out in the desert, you'd unzip yourself and have a pee. But the Arab soldiers, and I don't know why this custom is, all knelt down to take a pee. So I've got photos from this smart parade. Behind, I've got people having smoke breaks, buying cups of tea and coffee, and little sweetbreads, and everywhere you could see was Arab soldiers kneeling down, weeing. And that is seriously surreal. But I was the only photographer around there. So the world's media has seen the normal parade, and I'm seeing what's going on behind it. And that was the other story I'd thought of.
End of reel 5, Laurie Manton. Laurie Manton, reel 6. That's fascinating, isn't it? The difference between the front and the back.
Well, it shows a slight difference in culture.
Yes, that must have been interesting in itself, the that aspect of the Gulf War. The cultural Islamic side.
Well, seeing that, because it was quite difficult, because when we were sitting in Saudi Arabia in the various British bases, not many people could get out. And there'd been problems, whereas you had the religious thought police would go around And there'd been a famous case of a US Army female soldier with her combat jacket with the sleeves rolled up, and she was exposing bare elbows, and she was female. And one of the religious police came along in his log robes and hit her with a stick on her elbow, of which she flattened him, which created quite a little incident. So they were very wary about letting letting people out. But because I was slightly renegade and doing my own thing, I just applied for a pass. So every night I was able to go out into the town and go around the shops, which was fascinating, or go into a Lebanese restaurant or things like that. But I think they were very good, really, considering this invasion of almost like the Crusaders coming along, violating their customs, having women driving vehicles, which is not allowed, and all the rest of it. But I found, and it's not a criticism, because I think they're a professional fighting force, and I've done a lot previously and before the war with American forces. But the Americans were quite difficult. Their big problem was dealing with the media or anything out of the ordinary. Now, if you remember the media and you come across the British forces at that time, you go along and you see them and say, "Oh yeah, what are you up to?" "Oh yeah, we're just guarding this tree because it's an interesting tree and the nuts will fall off next week." And the general says, "We're not let anyone have them." But the American private was saying, "I'm sorry, I'll have to seek advice up the line." Now, we'd seen some of these missiles the Americans were using to knock down the Scuds. They were next to our base. And I drove around there. I went up to the American headquarters, got in there, said what I wanted. They gave me a pass to photograph these missiles. I then drove around to the base and said, "Here's my pass, I'd like to photograph the missiles." The private said, "I'll have to speak to the corporal." The corporal sent for the sergeant. The sergeant sent for the